The Muskie 360 Podcast is brought to you by Yeti, built for the wild, Evinrude E-Tech Outboards, Joe Bucher Outdoors, the number one name in Big Fish products, and The Muskie Shop.
All right, folks, welcome to The Muskie 360 Podcast Lockdown Edition. I've got my co-host, the sexiest man in musky fishing, Chaz Martin. How you doing, Chaz?
Stephen, when is my cover of the magazine going to be coming out?
The cover of the magazine?
Of the sexiest man in musky fishing? When is that happening? I'm excited.
Folks, go ahead and send your money to muskymastery.com. He has a Venmo as well. It's the Joe Bucher Moonface calendar featuring Chaz Martin. He's got a full spread there in the calendar.
Man,
in the calendar.
Tell me what the download count is on this. Jeez.
4.5.
Anyway, Stephen, it is, as always, great to be here, man.
As always.
Fired up for another podcast.
We promised you folks we're going to get to user questions. We have a ton of them. We're going to get through as many as we can.
Yeah, we just can't talk about world record muskies again. That would
we
be
can't.
Bad.
That, you know, I hope you're entertained, folks. We're doing our best to not go stir crazy here, and we're just going to jump right into it. So the first one is from Jason. Jason asks, what water temperature coincides with the seasons? I fish Lake of the Woods early July and water temps are in the mid 70s. What species are muskies preying on during that time? Are the fish that the muskies are preying on spawning? Okay, a lot
That's
to unpack
a great
there.
Question.
Yeah.
Wow, lots in that. Stephen, do you want me to go or do you want to go first?
Fire away, baby. Fire away.
I mean, boy, what did you say? Mid to upper 70s?
Yeah, mid to upper 70s.
Mid to upper 70s, I am going to cross my fingers and hope biologically I'm correct on this, that the fish that the muskies are preying on at that point in the season are not reproducing. At yep. least with the reason I'm saying that is, you know, with my gig in northern Wisconsin, you know, my perch run early in the year and my bluegill spawning run and all that stuff, by the time you're in the mid 70 point for surface temps, all of that is done.
Right.
And not that, you know, like our Canadian waters, they're not a panfish fisheries, obviously. But, you know, even like tulabies and ciscos and you know, they're not reproducing. So by that point, are we in the, I would call it midsummer.
Absolutely. And just to back you up there, do a quick Google searches. We've got walleye spawning temps on average 48 to 50.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Obviously, our tulabee are that fall transition.
They're in the fall, and you've got pike in the 40s as well, early
and
spring.
And spawning temp for perch is, as far as in Fahrenheit, is about that 65.5 mark is what they're saying. So, yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, so at that point, like, muskies probably are not going to be preying upon prey items that are reproducing, so to speak. But what was the other part of that question, Stephen? Like, what?
Let me get her pulled up here. And so he wanted if it coincides with the spawn. And basically, that's what he's getting at. You know, what water temperature coincides with the seasons? So he's sort of asking about the seasonality of water temperature. I mean, you know, if I'm looking
at... I have a... Sorry, go ahead.
No, fire away, man. You got this. You got it.
Yeah, well, you know, I have my general idea on, you know, for me, my spring water temp in, I'm just going to say, northern Wisconsin is anywhere from, I'll just call it 60 degrees on the low end. Let's call it 62 to 68, 69. And that is my spring, early summer water temperature in northern Wisconsin. I know it's a great number, and that's a great spectrum for early season is 60s. And I particularly love when my season, when we stick in the 60s for a long period of time, especially into July, I get pretty fired up because my shallow bite is just on fire. The big females for me seem to stay shallow longer. Mm-hmm. When I start to approach 72 and beyond, 72 to 80, and I dare I say the word 80 around here.
Uh-oh.
I know. I don't want to even say it.
Instant
but,
death.
I know, right? For those of us that still need to make a living in the fishing industry, you know, from 70 to 80, that's midsummer to me.
Right.
And at least in the Midwest. And then, you know, after, I'd say, boy, once we start hitting mid-August, that starts dropping pretty rapidly, actually. Mm-hmm. By late August, we're back into the 60s, and certainly by Labor Day weekend, we're 60s for sure. And then we go back into the 50s, and there you go.
Yeah, so, absolutely. I mean, the one thing I would say, because he's asking you what temperature coincides with the seasons, and Jason, one thing I would look at that is we never know. You know, like this year, I'm running colder, so the season's not going to dictate the temperature. The conditions will dictate your temperatures. And you know, I there's a guy that's a buddy of mine that's sort of in the same area you, where his ethos is throw top water until it bounces. You know, where it's like I'm throwing top water till there's ice.
I think that's so true, though, too. It's like these misconceptions that are out there. It's funny how, like, as you age in the musky industry, like how you start to see that some of these things you grew up with thinking
you don't
are not true.
Yeah, they're not
like
true.
They're so wrong. Anyway, I don't want to get off topic.
No, we got No, you're right.
You know, it just made me think of like Tony Rizzo, like rest in peace. Tony was just like one of our founding fathers, essentially.
And,
you know, it's like Secrets of a Muskie Guide 1 and Secrets of a Muskie Guide 2, I would say, boy, those are two books to look into that, boy, they really break a season down by water temperature, albeit they're Wisconsin, but you can apply it anywhere. It doesn't
Absolutely.
Matter where, you know.
And, the tangent there being the seasonal temperatures and what these fish are doing are far different in Tennessee than they are on Lac Seul, on the other end of the spectrum. You know, far different than Eagle. So you're going to have to know your body of water. You know, Lake of the Woods is a cool place where there's a lot of common knowledge there. So just sort of dip into that, you know, really dig into, you know, what you're seeing as far as those mid-70s bites, things of that nature. But definitely, Chaz, you and I can agree, any spawning's done that we're aware of those major forage bases.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're in that upper, mid to upper 70s, it's I would call that midsummer, you know, no matter where you're at. If you're like in, you know, you name it, that's midsummer period for sure.
Absolutely. The next one up is from Jeff Z. Hello, I recently won a half-day guided muskie trip. Well, congratulations on that. And I was wondering about tipping. Okay, I'm sorry I'm chuckling. As you guys know, I do not pre-read these questions, so this is going to be interesting. So Jeff Z says, I recently won a half-day muskie trip, and I was wondering about tipping. I know how much the guide charges for a regular rate. I would like to know if it's generally a certain percentage of the total I should tip. I would assume it's based on experience as well, but let's just say it's a satisfactory experience. He has a second part. Also, do you guys prefer providing equipment or letting the angler bring their own?
Ooh.
I'm going to fire away real quick on the tipping.
Fire away, Steve.
I'm going to fire away on the tipping thing because this is the deal. And this is the way I feel on my boat. Me and Chaz are both guides. If this is your first time listening or you don't know who we are, we're both professional guides. Here's the deal. The way I look at it, you've already paid to catch your fish. Whether we get it or not, you've already paid. I don't expect a tip. Tipping stands for to ensure proper service. That's what that stands for. So, like, you know, don't go out with a guy and if he's a jerk face all day long and you catch a nice fish, I don't think it's like a necessity that you have to tip him. I don't think I don't think it's an expectation. Now, if he's chill and he's a nice guy and you have a good time on the water, absolutely sort of show that gratitude. But I don't think you should feel obligated.
I'll chime in on that first part of it with you, man. Steven, I completely agree. Like my rates for guiding are my rates and I'm happy to get that money as a professional. Like that's my rate and that's out. I'm not expecting a tip.
No.
When I'm thinking about like my income for the year and what I'm expecting to make, I'm not basing it off of tips.
Absolutely.
Like tips are, as you mentioned, it is a above and beyond part for the consumer to say, hey, look, it's not an expectation. If you really did have a great time and you enjoyed what you learned, and you enjoyed the camaraderie that you experienced and the learning. Even if you don't catch a muskie or not, muskies are tough to catch. I don't know where you're from, you know. But if you enjoyed it and you learned something and you walk away saying, "Man, like I had a great day," you know, yeah. Then if you want a tip, just like any other service in the service industry, that is highly thankful, but not. At least for Steve and I, it sounds like we're on the same page. Yeah. Like I'm not expecting it, but if you do, that's awesome.
Absolutely.
We've probably both had customers that are all, you know, the neatest thing is that it certainly doesn't matter what walk of life you are from. I've had customers all over the place that are working so many different industries, and they all tip so differently. And you know, not that it matters, but you know, it's all unique to you and your guide trip.
Don't feel I think me and you could both probably go off on that tangent real quick about, you know, I had guys that have come out that are loaded and catch a PB and they don't give you anything. And
have guys that are that are working like a you know, some other type of job that certainly wouldn't be, you know, considered loaded, and they'll tip you something outrageous. Right. And you're like, oh my God, like I don't deserve this. And they're like, no, take it.
But never, I never. And I've turned tips down that I felt were exorbitant. Don't feel like you have to tip your guide. Don't.
No.
But don't.
Much appreciated.
We'll get hate mail for that. This one.
Much appreciated, you know, especially if you're traveling a lot too. I should say, you know, I guess sometimes, and I think about the back of my mind, I guess I'd say, like, you know, on a full day trip, if I'm bumping, you know, 3-4 different waters,
right,
you know, and you're like, you know, you're burning some gas, and I don't care.
Cause in the back of my mind, that's part of the deal.
All I care about is producing a muskie. Like, that's all I care about is having a good time for my clients and trying my best off, you know, working my butt off to produce some fish. And if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, like, I'm not going to be looking at somebody saying, hey, you know, a little extra cash. Never.
Absolutely. I'm never going to happen. Never.
It's part of the job, and it's part of the excitement. It's part of why we guide.
Yeah. And that's a thing, I think. God, I'm not going to go off. We gotta stay focused. But I'll say this. The reason Chaz and I guide, guys like us end up guiding, is it kicks the challenge up a notch. So not only do you have to catch a muskie, but you've got to entertain somebody for like 8 to 12 hours. So it's like, I've got to run my mouth. I've got to keep you from freaking out because we haven't caught a fish yet. And so... You know, if you got a fun guide, if you have an entertaining trip, yeah, man, show them some love, but it is not necessary. If you're a client of mine or a future client or whatever, and you listen to this, I don't care. There's no expectation. And I don't think there should ever be an expectation. You know, we're there for that experience. And we're at the end of the day, I think a guide above all else is learning on the client's dime.
Yes.
I mean, it's a fact. I mean, anybody that says anything else is a liar on a lot of fronts is like, you know, we're happy to be there. And I know I do this. I know Chaz does this. It's just trying to provide the best experience possible. So don't feel obligated. That's that. Amen. I'll end it that. The other thing.
Can I jump into that second part?
Oh, here? Yeah.
Now, which you and I
love this one.
You and I are going to differ on this because it's kind of interesting, you know, our different experiences and personalities.
Oh, full spool Chaz Martin, folks.
Full Stephen Ball.
he actually literally has a handle on 3,000 yards of bee spray. That's it.
No, don't ask Jeff Koons about my bee spray account. Oh my God.
Lord. Okay. that's why I can't get any, folks. Blame this guy. Right?
It's all sitting in my garage. Now, as far as, you know, bringing your own equipment, boy, I got to say two things. First of all, come on my boat, and I'm not trying to be too sponsory or anything, but here's my take as a guide. Use my equipment.
No, we're going to be on the same page. I know where you're going.
Okay, God, use my equipment. Mm-hmm. It is there for a reason. Experiment with different rod powers and actions and my reels and my lures. And there's so much I can go into on this, but I'm going to say, please use my stuff. And what I'd recommend for clients, and you know, customers of mine who might be listening, bring your stuff, bring your stuff and I will gladly, like smiling, take a look at your equipment and give it a once over or give you the yes or the no. But I have had, and I'm speaking strictly from experience on lost and it just on lost muskies that I'm so sad sometimes to, and you know what happens as you age in the guiding industry, you make your mistakes here and there, you learn. But we've lost a lot of muskies when I was younger on letting clients bring their equipment. And I'm not talking just like, I'm not going to name any names,
right?
But like, you know, whatever equipment they're talking. I mean, I'm talking about clients that brought like the top of the line, $500 rods, $500 reels, the newest line, and something for whatever reason doesn't go right with client setups. And it's because mine are professionally tuned.
They're ready to go.
I tied my darn knots. I made sure the drag is set properly. And let's just throw this out there, Stephen, because I know we will agree on this. When you're in the grind, like, and you're like guiding on day 20 in a row, full days.
Oh yeah.
Somebody puts like a Legend Elite in your hand, and you're like, oh yeah, this looks good. The line's brand new. Like you're not thinking about their equipment. Like you're in another like realm of like thinking. And sometimes it's like my stuff is fine tuned. I'm in tune with my everything that's going on, my boat, my electronics, my gear, everything's ready. So come with my stuff and leave your stuff at home. And that's where I'm at. I'm done. You know what? Off the soapbox. That's one of my biggest. If you're throwing my lures, they are going to be
tied.
You're
on my rod.
My knots.
Yes.
It's my knots, my lures.
Preach on. Hallelujah. That's where I'm at, dude.
Dude, I get really fired up on this.
Yeah, because here's the deal. And probably the worst thing, and okay, tangent. I'm going to keep it short here.
Good. Go on a tangent.
Is like Chaz does the same thing. I like my lures on the boat because I'm spending so much time on there, they're all like grails. Like it's not a question if that has that bait caught a muskie. It has, and I don't like losing lures. So I want my clients to throw my gear because I know it's been gone through and it's good to go. That's pretty much what it boils down to. The one caveat I would give is this, is reels. And there are so many muskie reels on the market right now that that's sort of where I differ. Mm-hmm. Is like I had a guy, shout out to Mike from Kansas. I know you're listening. He actually loves the podcast. He's a good dude.
Awesome.
We talked about it and he brought his own reels because they were both, he and his wife were both throwing tranks. And I think what's tough for a guide right now is like, I flatly cannot afford having Alexa, having a Calcutta, having an Abu, Beast, having a Daiwa, you know, having like
all the different models.
So the one caveat I would give is this, is if you are comfortable with a certain reel and you're an avid muskie fisherman, bring it along and say, hey, do you care if I use this? If that's like the reel you're comfortable with. If you're a novice and you really don't, and you got to be honest with yourself and say, hey, this is really, you know, I'm learning a bunch here. Fish whatever the guide's got. But if there's a reel you're comfortable with, bring it on. You know, I can think of maybe one time out of hundreds that I've ever gone, hey, man, this reel sort of janky, you know, and we might want to use something
else.
I
got to give a little shout out here. Here's a quick other on your tangent. Shout out to Adam Stein from Overland, Kansas. Uh-huh. Here's the guy. And I don't even want to go down the list of stories that we got with Stephen Adam Stein, but like here's a guy these guys are bass nuts, man, from kind of in your neck of the woods. I'll just say southern guys are bass nuts, and these guys have come up for a long, long time with me guiding. And to your point, and you and I are just we're hitting it off on this on this question. Adam is a big fan of small, low profile reels.
Yeah.
But his rods and Adam, if you're listening, and I'm gonna send you a link to this anyway, his rods didn't cut it. They're, you know, heavy power bass rods. We didn't cut it in the big musky world. But the thing was, I outfitted Adam's reels with, you know, 65-pound test Beast braid, and I put them on my guide rods, my 8'6", and they were the lightest things. They were like lightsabers. It was unbelievable, and we make it happen every year. And so I agree with you. I guess my big caveat is So I guess I'd say, like, any reel works as long as the line is new.
Mm-hmm.
Don't bring line that's a year old. I don't want
dry rotted.
Last year that you're like, oh, I only fished like three times. I don't care if you fish three times. I want new line. Otherwise you're using my line.
Yeah.
And it just when you have so much invested in the sport, you can't afford to lose fish over baloney things.
No.
I just don't like it. Anyway.
Oh yeah. I mean, and that's like my holy grail glide rater. You say that. I promised before we did this podcast, me and Chaz promised we would get through these quickly, and we're not. We're always going to be on tangents.
I know. And we'll try to.
But you said that, and the thing that sort of was a kicker for me online, my holy grail glide rater that has caught like two of the biggest fish I've ever caught, I let a guy throw it, and it went bloop and goes flying off. So I spent like an hour in the water. I got it back, by God. I got it back, but, you know, digging around, I think that's the same thing you worry about. Is like, it's not the matter that it's a glide rater or it's a shallow rater or it's this bait or that bait. It's like, it's that particular model.
Oh, my God. Don't even get me started. Joe and I had this conversation, too, where I'm like, I'm telling him about, like, because I won't go down.
We got to keep moving.
Number one importance for me is the rod and the line.
Absolutely.
You can bring your own reel. If the line is new, you're going to use my rod. If you don't have a good rod, and I tie the knots.
Absolutely. I hear you. So we'll sum that up by bring gear, but be flexible as a client.
Ooh, that's, I like that.
I think that because of the being flexible thing of, you
I
know,
like that.
God,
that's
here
really
we are. We're on the tangents, but we're coming back. Is the other thing that pops in my head, I have guys show up and, you know, I'm fishing 8.6.
Oh, you're going to another tangent?
Well, I am a little bit. Like, I've had guys that by the end of the trip, they're buying longer rods. So be flexible with your guide.
Right?
You know, be flexible. We'll move on. Next one up is Dustin. Dustin says, love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you very much. I know Chaz appreciates as well.
Wow.
What are some tips for staying focused during an all-day grind? For instance, let's say, man, I always laugh because of cool questions. Like, I have a tick here. What are some tips for staying focused during an all-day grind? For instance, let's say you're on day two or three of a fishless trip. How do you stay focused and not get frustrated or give up? Oh, man.
I love this.
I love this question. Because hopefully it'll be in the video. Old Book Daddy listening there. I gave him the what for on a trip this past August. You know, everybody,
let's hear it.
Everybody gets grumpy. I'm calling you out, Booker, if you're listening. So the man, the myth, the legend, the grandfather, the godfather of all this.
As Chris Cadorzi says, the moon man himself.
The moon man himself. Everybody, a moment of reverence. All right. Thank you very much. Yeah. So, Joe Booker himself turned 65 on the last trip we went on.
Oh, my gosh.
His birthday. And he went 3 days. And it's not something I don't know, you know, how much he would mention that. But he went 3 days. Now, I was behind him. I'm like a human zane, so I wouldn't want to fish with me on the boat either. But we were having a really tough trip. And even Joe got down. You know, and me and the guru, or Tyler Andrews, we started ragging him. You know, it's like, man, perk up. Everybody gets frustrated, you know, and there's even a thing, I hope they put in the episode, me and Tyler started chanting, Booker, 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 just to get him revved up, which is crazy because like 30 seconds later, he caught a fish. But,
well, you know, every year, dude, on his birthday, he catches a giant. And I don't know what, it's actually hilarious. Like,
it's not even fair. He just does. But everybody gets that way. You know, and the reason I bring that up, and I'm not ragging on Joe, I love Joe to death, but here's a dude that's got nothing to prove. He's caught more big muskies than I'll ever even dream about catching.
That's the beauty of your story here, is the guy has got, he's done it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's human just like us. Like,
right.
And we all get there, but like, how do you rally? How do you come back?
How do you rally? Be dumb enough to be out there.
Well, that you just I mean,
that's it.
I mean, there's a lot of things like you never stop casting until like either physically you cannot go any further,
and
or
that's when you troll.
Yeah,
I mean
exactly. But you know, I would say one thing on my end, and this is a weird like Chazism of sorts. Uh-huh. Like when I'm out there by myself, like how many times? And I know there's a lot of listeners that have got to be like, oh my god, I do that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
How many times I am like literally like a freaking nutcase imagining a world record eating my lure,
yep,
and giving myself the chills. Yep. Like literally the entire time I'm fishing, I'm wondering what it would look like. Like what would it look like? Like I'm constantly racking my brain. Like, how would it eat this, or what would it do? And I'm like, I'm constantly going through that. And I also, I guess I'd say this last thing, and this is probably the biggest, most like, it's probably the most mature thing I've ever said on the podcast.
Boo! Right, don't be mature.
Yeah, I know. Chaz Martin being mature. I would say this, and I'm young, and you know, Steven, you and I are both in the same ballpark on this, but there's definitely something like, let's say, a decade ago, when I was 22 mm-hmm. versus 32, like. In the last 10 years, as I've been working, most folks know that I'm a teacher. Like, I don't know, whatever you do for a living, like, it doesn't matter. But as I've grown older, my time on the water has become more precious to me.
Yes.
And even if I'm not catching a muskie, and I feel like, Steven, you and I talked about this, like, literally a day ago, where, like, it obviously it matters. We want to catch fish. But, like, as far as like rallying the troops go, like I feel like as I've gotten older, I've grown just more gracious for my time just fishing. Like yeah. If the bite is tough, the bite is tough. If you're, I mean, you got to be trying everything in the playbook. You got to be trolling. You got to be suspended. You got to be doing everything. You got to be like, doing goofy stuff. You've got to be inventing lures on the spot. You got to mm-hmm. be doing that. But if you're doing that and it's still tough, you just enjoy it at a certain point.
Just
and
I can't agree any more than that.
I mean, you just you have to. If you don't, as Joe would say, pick up a different sport. Go to golf or badminton or you know.
I mean, and that question, obviously, Dustin is he's been there, you know.
Exactly, and we all have.
And you keep coming back to the trough, and I mean, that's why I caught, you know, I'm blowing our friend Joe out here. That Joe gets frustrated. Everybody gets there. And it's how you come back, man.
You know what? I got to say this. This is I just thought of another. So I thought of a moment here, if I mm-hmm. might share real quick.
Lay it
on me. I'll keep this short and sweet. I'm on a film trip with another YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
And my buddy Mike and I are in no baloney here. We're in the 16th hour of mm-hmm. filming. And we had lost one big muskie, and we knew it was big, and it was like a tearjerker loss.
Right.
We're neck and neck with this other YouTube channel, and but it's all for fun, obviously. But you know, right. you know how it is. 16 hours, and we ended up not catching one for that 16 hour stretch. Mm-hmm. And I would say, as we moved into the next day, the biggest thing, as far as a momentum builder for me. And I would say the same thing as a professional educator, a teacher. I could say any profession you
right.
have. This is probably the biggest thing we got in our back pocket as professionals or as semi-professionals, whatever you like to think of yourself as a muskie angler. Here it is.
Right.
Self-reflection.
Yep.
Reflecting on what has transpired, reflecting on the past, putting some pen to paper and thinking about what happened, where you've been, what's going on, like think outside of the box. Like self-reflection is probably one of the best ways to get yourself back into the mm-hmm. game. Like is think, like step away for a second, like
yeah,
you know, whatever, pull the boat to shore,
have a sandwich,
have a sandwich, like, and think about what's happening, you know, because I as a science teacher, you gotta say, like, there is an answer sometimes to what's going on, like biologically, not that you can get the fish to eat, but like if you're hitting a roadblock, like there is something's happening within that ecosystem that maybe you're not seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And taking a step back, okay, I'm done.
Moving on. I hear you, man. You're on point. Next one up is from Brian. Brian asks, what colors for West Branch Lake in Ohio? Brian, I'm going to jump right quick. I have not fished West Branch Lake, but if you go to the 101 tab on the Muskie 360 app, there's a color chart that pretty much covers all the musky lure colors.
Steven, what color water is that?
I have no clue.
West Branch. It sounds like a stained. It sounds like stained water to me. Uh-huh. If I guess.
There's no telling, but you know, you can go regardless if it's clear, if it's tannic, if it's stained. That chart's going to have all that info for you as far as like how to dial in on that.
I'm throwing my color out.
Lay
Are
it
you
on
throwing
me.
Your color out?
I'm throwing
my color out. This is my clear water, stained water. I don't care where you're fishing color.
Lay it
my
on me.
Go-to color, and I'm going to throw the size out and the whole lure and all. 700 Goldilocks. That is probably the one lure for me.
Right.
I mean, like, that's like Goldilocks and 700 Brookertail has probably caught more fish in stained water, clear water. I don't care where
it
I
doesn't
fish.
Matter what it is. Yeah.
That just, there you go. Throw that. That's my take.
Well, the fun factoid about Goldilocks, you guys actually have stopped filming with it so much because it was such a popular color.
It is funny. They told us to stop.
Yeah. They're like, lay off. We can't make enough of these things. It's like, we got 300 Elvises laying over here at the factory, you know, or something like that. Yeah. I mean, Brian, it's a case by case basis. And that can change. I don't know West Branch Lake, but that color pattern or the color preference can change day to day. So check out that chart.
Absolutely.
It's going to have all the different conditions, all the different water clarity levels, and you can sort of dial in on that on a day-to-day basis.
And that's the beauty of it. Experiment. Get out there.
Yeah, there's not a smoking gun. There just isn't. So next one up is Mitch. What are the differences between jakes, cranebaits, and shallow raters?
We were just talking about cranes the other day.
He says, do I need to buy all of them? Oh, excuse me. He says, do I need to buy all of them? Do they do different things, or am I just buying the same bait from different companies? Wow. Mitch, I'm going to jump real deep on this. They're all different. That's why I think like the three brands that you mentioned, Jake's, which are Drifter Tackle, Cranes, and Shallow Raiders. The reason those baits have had longevity is because they all do different things.
Well, again, think about, Jake's, the lip is rounded.
Mm-hmm.
Cranes and Shallow Raiders are square-billed.
Square-billed, yeah.
So, I mean, they are completely different. And,
completely.
Like, everything about them is so different. We're talking plastic. We're talking balsa wood.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, like, they're totally different. So, Steven, keep diving in, man.
I fish both crane baits and Shallow Raiders. And crane baits are like exceptionally buoyant, and shallow raiders have a slower rise. But the thing with like a crane bait is a crane bait's a disposable bait, which a shallow raider will last forever, you know? So you've got some differences just off the rip there. As far as I would assume we're talking from your question, if you're talking crane baits, shallow raiders versus jakes, I'm assuming we're talking twitch bait sizes and stuff. You know, they're a 6-inch jake, a 6-inch crane bait, and a 6-inch shallow raider, a 5-inch shallow raider, just completely different baits to me. What you need to do is get your hands on one of each and throw them and watch them in the water. That's the only way I can convey this to you. I could sit here and take me 30 minutes on the podcast to say, this bait does this, this bait does this, but just put them on and straight retrieve, and you can watch like the flat side nature of a jake. And the way that bill is, like you said, Chaz, rounded, is going to roll differently in the water. Where a shallow raider's got that square bill and it's like, it's a little more acute, you know, and a crane bait is just like the second you stop reeling it, it's back up to the surface, it seems like. So if we're talking stock out of the package, they're all different. They're all going to do different things. I've seen bodies of water where it's like they won't hit a jake, but they'll hit a crane bait, or the bodies of water where they won't hit a crane bait, but they'll hit a shallow raider. So as being as much of a musky lure nut as I am, buy them all. But
gonna say the same thing. I mean, like everything you get into in this world seems to be more and more expensive as you dial yourself into it, right? I mean, everybody says, well, yeah, you can be a successful musky angler with one lure. You can't. There's no doubt about it. Absolutely. But if you want to dial in on particular bodies of water, you want to dial in particular environmental conditions, and you can keep the list going there. You've got to have, as Joe said it very best in one of his most recent blogs, regarding musky rods. You know, why would you have five or six musky rods in the boat? And I'm a golfer. I'm going to tie these two together, Stephen. Why do you have different musky rods? Because why do you need different golf clubs in the game of golf?
Yeah,
because you hit different shots from different distances. You know, there's all different types of conditions. Same thing in musky world. Yeah. You need different rods because you got different lures. And why do you have different lures? And even within the realm of crankbaits, why do you have different crankbaits? Well, there's so many different, like you said, crankbaits are so buoyant.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certain circumstances where you need a super buoyant lure over a lure that's less buoyant. And that is needed in a variety of conditions. It just depends how, and we're talking, relatively speaking, not a giant financial investment.
No. You know,
to buy three crankbaits versus one, I would get all three.
Absolutely. And I mean, the thing that I think that a lot of people sort of latch onto is you and I, and especially Joe, talking about how to make these baits more versatile. If you are, and I obviously we're biased. I mean, I'm going to tell you flatly, we're biased on this subject. But if I was only going to get one, it's going to be a shallow rater. The reason being, a crane bait, and I love crane baits, they're disposable. A Jake is not the best twitch bait. I always think of a Jake as more of a trolling kind of presentation.
Yeah, I would agree with you on
you
that.
Know, and
not,
like
to,
a
not to throw shade.
Right, not, and
shade,
not like, I, trust me, I got 14-inch Jakes loaded in the boat, 12-inch Jakes, love them. Crane baits coming out the ears. But as far as like, if Mitch is looking for like a singular, start with the shallow rater because you're going to get the most out of it. As far as,
I agree with you.
And like I said, we're biased, but I mean, even if it wasn't on the app or the Muskie 360 podcast, I would tell you the same thing, because you can do more with that bait as far as like augmenting buoyancy, changing hooks, things of that nature, the stuff we're always talking about.
Hey, you can do more. Yeah. The shallow rater, I would say,
like, it lends itself to modifications.
Try not to be biased, I guess.
Yeah.
Like the shallow rater and the Jake, you can do more modifications to and get more out of them, I think, than you probably could. I'm not trying to diss the crane.
No.
But the crane is like so buoyant in a sense that you can't do things with that you can with a shallow rater.
No.
And you already said.
Yeah. And like, then my big hang up with those is, I mean, I love them to death, but 2-3 fish, they're done.
Oh, they get chewed.
They're just done. Right. Yeah. It's like typical. Like you strap on a new mag dog, and the first fish it hits, it's like a hammer handle pike, and he's swimming away with your tail.
Right?
You're like, I spent $30 for a pike to take the tail off this bait. So
brutal.
And that's a thing. And I mean, you know, I'm assuming if Mitch is sort of weighing the odds between all these, he's on the fence. Start with the shallow rater, then add to your collection, man.
I like that.
Yeah. The next up is Joe. And not Joe Booker, I'm not assuming. I don't think Joe's – I read the first sentence. Joe is not in Ohio, if you're looking for Joe. Joe says, I'm fishing Ohio in a lake that generally has mostly clear water. Over winter, they lowered the lake level by 8 feet to keep flooding down in the area. The lake is at normal pool now, but it's not even close to being clear. I've been out 4 times and haven't raised a single fish. I've tried big lures and I've tried small lures. Water temps are between 45 and 50. What am I doing wrong?
Probably going too fast.
There's a second little section of this. He said, would you say these fish are pre-spawn? I've marked several large fish right on top of each other in bays in about 10 feet of water. You know, what am I doing wrong? What should I do? So he's seeing some big fish, which could be, in my opinion, especially in Ohio, it could be carp, it could be anything, cats, you know, as far as how much you trust your electronic.
True, as far as what you're seeing.
But, you know, that, man, I'll tell you right off the rip, you know, 45 to 50 is a tough water temp. 45 to 55, in my opinion, are tough water temps.
I didn't want to be too critical on that, like going too fast, but man, that's cold water.
And it's like we're dealing with metabolism. We're dealing with fish that don't have to eat that often to maintain their caloric intake. So, it's tough. You nailed it with that speed. Speed kills. And once again, now I'm gonna rub it in on the old Chaz Martin here. When we're,
you know, I guarantee you're going for the spool.
Oh, it's coming for the spool, baby. If you're not at full pull, Don't be at full spool. Thank you very much. That's a Steve Paulism right there. So
that's if nice.
the lower the water levels, the less line I have on my reels. So the reason being is when fish, these muskies are encounter less than perfect conditions, the slower I go. So if I'm dealing with 45 to 50 degree water, which I do often, I'm going to slow down tremendously. Now, the tip that I have with that, let's say we're going to fish crank, so that slow speed presentations for me are bulldogs, depth raiders, and dive and rise like a suic. But all of these take a little bit of a different feel. Okay, so I'm just going to fill you in. Chaz, you be thinking about what your take is on this.
I got my take on this. I'm waiting to see if you say.
Right, so my deal with like a bulldog is like wicked slow. It's like rip, pop, pop. Rip, pop, pop. That's it. So that's sort of my timing, and I'm in those tiny temperatures. Slow, it's in their face. My number one, though, is a depth raider, and I add weight to it. And the reason I'm adding weight to it is because I'm retrieving it straight and slow. And I should have said a jointed depth raider. But the deal is a jointed depth raider with lead tape on the front. And the reason I'm retrieving it with the lead tape on it, and the reason I'm doing that is I'm going so slow that it's not achieving its target depth. So the depth raider for me is the best like go-to in those temperatures, because I'm talking rod up, pointed up in the air, and I'm just barely turning that handle and getting that bait going tick, tick, tick.
Now, I'm
going to
take
tick.
Can I go off?
Fire
this
away, baby. Fire away.
So I'm also going to agree with Stephen on this. And I'm going to say that in your circumstances, my go-to lure, and this is a hands down for me, my best producer is a jointed depth raider, so I'm in a total agreement with you. But I'm going to give you another option here, and I know Stephen agrees with me on this,
trolling.
When I am in cold water, man, I am a trolling machine. I do better on artificials than I even do, to a certain extent, compared to
soccer,
fishing live bait. Yeah, I love trolling, and I have to give Joe a big thanks on this, even though we've been throwing a lot of Joeisms out there on this podcast. You know, trolling for me is such an amazing tactic when I'm dealing with cold water, because I cover such a giant expanse. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, you mentioned it, Stephen, inactive muskies or muskies in a neutral mood or metabolism. Well, when you got that as an issue, cover water and try to get your lure in front of as many muskies as you can over the course of your day or whatever. And again, the best way to do that, in my opinion, is trolling, and you can cover just such a wide expanse.
Absolutely.
And you can go so slow on trolling too, especially if you got, I don't care what you got a 50 E-Tech like me, or if you got a kicker or whatever you got, you know, you can go slow in trolling as well and achieve what we talked about, going slow. And especially if you're like marking fish at different depths, you know, go to the Muskie 360. Stephen, what section we got that line depth and trolling in?
It's under 101, and it's under the My 360. So you've got two ways to access all those trolling charts.
Check out those trolling charts and experiment. If you're marking fish, you know, 10 feet down or 12 feet down, run your cranks at that depth and put a significant amount of time doing it. And you know, sooner or later, you're going to hit an active fish.
One thing that sort of popped in my head, also to think about, like, you know, cause Ohio, West Virginia, and we're sort of in that obviously it's the Midwest, but it's sort of that midpoint where it's not quite Southern, not quite Northern, just sort of that midpoint. One thing I would recommend is getting a cheap fish tank thermometer and putting either an extension on it or just submerging it. Because the one thing I've noticed is, like, if I'm dealing with that 45 to 50 degree water, I want to know if that's permeating the entire water column. I want to sort of like probe those depths and check out those water depths. Like, I want to know, is it 50 degrees at 10 feet?
Is there a thermocline?
Yes. Is like the surface temperature 50, but like 6 feet down, it's like 44.
Because that could box them. You
can box them in real quick. So that's something to consider. You know,
you're getting real Tom Gelbish
Oh, buddy, I'm a Tom Gelber all day long. I've got the oldest Hawk thermometer on my boat. You know what I'm talking about? The probes. It's like it's literally wood grain because it's from the 80s. But I always wanted to know what that subsurface temperature is, especially in cold water temps, because that'll help you box them in and sort of narrow your presentation zone a little bit. But, man, me and you are both going to agree, number one takeaway is slow down.
Yeah, I think, and it's something that you and I have talked about so much over the, just oddly, the last couple of weeks, because it's cold out right now. Slow.
Yep. Slower reels, less line on your reels. If you have a fast reel, you know, Chaz would have a conniption fit. You wouldn't believe how much money I save on line by doing that. So, all right, the next one up is from Andy. Please describe, I love it, right to reels, here we go. Andy says, please describe what reels to use with what type of baits. It can get confusing trying to find the right reel that would work for plastics, twin tens, or crankbaits. I will tell you this, Andy, I sent your question to Joe Booker, and his new vlog is about your question. And a lot of other people have asked this, so Joe has a new vlog coming out. It'll be available on the app this week. So you can check that out.
By the
out.
Way, you're talking about me being the sexiest man in muskie fishing,
yes,
right?
Sir.
Those are my hands in Joe's new thumbnail.
Are they really?
Just FYI, yeah.
There's some.
You know what? That's probably my cover page right
those
there.
Are some hunky hands, my friend. Those are some hunky hands.
That's about as good as I can do.
That is wonderful. So we'll go ahead and move on. Like I said, Andy, check out that vlog. The Book Daddy himself is addressing that and a whole vlog for you. Ben says, I have two theories about when to use bigger baits and when to downsize that are independent of weather conditions. So Andy's got a theory here.
I can't wait to hear this. Okay.
I was wondering if either of you thought either of these had validity based on your professional experience. Well, we'll see. In listening to the Muskie 360 podcast, a common suggestion for river muskie fishing is to throw smaller lures. My logic as to why this makes sense is because river muskies don't have an ideal resting area to digest larger meals. Could this also apply to lake muskies and their relation to deeper water? Okay, so I actually will be out here very shortly. I have a vlog that's coming out on river muskies. We'll talk about this a little bit, but we'll get into the question. It has a second half. This is a big, big, long question here. Will a muskie that's on structure 25 to 50 yards off of deep water be more apt to go after something big versus something small that's further away from the structure? So what he's trying to do, Ben is trying to narrow down, are muskies that are tighter to structure or further away from structure going for smaller or bigger presentations. Well, I know what he's
because you got a vlog coming out, Steven.
Yeah.
And I want to ask this. I think I'm visualizing, I'm a visual guy.
Right.
I'm visualizing this. We got two scenarios going. We got river muskies, we got lake muskies.
Right.
And
which
I
are
think
two different balls,
of,
yeah.
Yeah, they're two different ball games. So one, I mean, maybe tackle the river. Is that tackle the river?
Yeah, like I said, I'm trying to dissect it. We read these questions live as they came in here. So, river muskies. Here's my deal. At least my philosophy and why I'm always saying downsize are smaller presentations is quick, easy forage. Bam, bam. I want the active fish. I want the fish that are actively feeding. And I'm also my theory. Is if I put a snack in front of a fish, it's an easier commitment than putting a big bait in front of them. So if I'm running and gunning on quick moving water, I want a and when I say downsize, I'm talking, you know, shallow
it's
raider.
All relative.
Yeah, it's all relative. Yeah. I'm not throwing like bass size cranks and stuff, but you know, typical 700 Booker tail, baby shallow raider, you know, 7-inch twitch bait, stuff like that.
You think about that in the fish world. I mean, like if you caught a perch the size of a 7-inch shallow raider, I mean, it's a very small little perch.
Right.
Those are downsized lures.
Yeah. Those are downsized lures. So, you know, that's my thought process. It's just because it's a easier commitment for those fish, which is sort of like what you're thinking on some level on your question. Is that a stone cold fact? It's not, because there's many a times that I'm throwing, you know, 9-inch shallow raiders, I'm throwing mag dogs, I'm throwing 12-inch suics, you know, I'm throwing double tens.
I'm not going down this road.
Yeah.
But I'm just gonna peek. and peek at our old vlog, the Strange Times, and say, look, man, there are some muskies in these waters that you could throw a 40-inch lure out there, and that might just attract them. But
yeah,
because I mean, look, man, like I mean, there are some big fish eat big stuff, and it depends on the water temperature, it depends on the time of the year, it depends on your forage base and what you got going on. So many factors.
Yes,
there are so many factors, but I think that what you said to start this question off, whether you're fishing a river, a reservoir, or a lake, I mean, downsizing and throwing like, you know, small to mid-sized lures, I like that idea. But, you know,
but
that, you can at least, you can get a rise out of a fish, even a big fish.
But that's a guide thing, though, too, is because I know you and I are, and we've never talked about it, but I'll just say it flat out, is as a guide, and probably a lot of our thought process is, I'm not going for the biggest, I want one in the net.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, you know, am I going to start my, and I think what he's extrapolating from like our podcast and from other stuff me and you have theorized about is this is, I mean, we're skewed a little bit because I don't come out of the box throwing Bigfoot double tens, and I also don't come out of the box throwing 500s. I'm always just going for that middle of the road to get one in the net. And I think that's a lot of it, you know, and I understand what he's asking, like, you know, should I always be downsized and targeting? I mean, but on any given day, it's like you got to play with it all.
Well, you know, and I talked about this. I was just doing a vlog today, getting some stuff kind of prepped for the coming weeks. And one of the things, I would say this, if I could throw this into the mix, is there's, I mean, this question's great because there's so many different ways to attack it. But when you're talking about, no matter, I don't care, again, we're talking river versus lake and whatever you're doing, regardless of that, you look at the, and even time of year, I'm going to say that's irrelevant. And what I'm going to say here is that when you look at the environmental factors, as far as like, do you have a front moving in? Here's what I'm getting at, I guess, in a nutshell. If I foresee muskies being in a more aggressive mood, is like the hunter in me is instinctively thinking, look, muskies should be eating right now, or they should be aggressive, I'm more apt to throw something bigger.
Yeah.
If I am thinking that, like, okay, environmental conditions are tough for whatever reason it is, I'm going to go small.
But, you know, that's the thing is, like, in this question, that's the one thing that was not brought up. And Ben, I would say this is like what Chaz's thing is. It's not about where I'm at. It's about everything. And I think man, that's
so what, much that goes
dude,
into
that's
it.
Why it's so hard at times to deliver an answer without caveat. There's always, I mean, in muskie fishing period, it seems like every time somebody asks me a question, I always go, this is what I would do, but.
You know, because it's neat to think about, and I agree. Like, I do quite a bit of trout fishing in rivers and streams and stuff, and I do think about that, where you've got a fish that's constantly moving, right?
Right.
And when they eat something, they're always moving, or they're in current. But still, the same like idea applies. Like, I always think of muskies like all of our animals that live in this world. It's like they are, like, by natural selection, like the most efficient versions of creatures that have come to exist. And these creatures haven't gotten there. I mean, it's not a smartness thing. It's an efficiency thing.
Right.
And these things, these animals, you know, they, I do feel that there's something to be said for the ease or the amount of energy that they need to expend to eat. And and these, they wouldn't be around. These muskies wouldn't be in existence if they expended more energy than they needed to eat.
You're killing it, because literally, I mean, I just spent a couple hours in the river vlog today, and you pretty much, you're still on my thunder, and I love it, because that's my whole river philosophy.
Right.
Is muskie, I mean, like, locations are easy because it's caloric risk versus caloric reward.
Absolutely. You can I can't even say it any more than that. That is a scientific way to think about fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Done.
End of subject.
Yeah, man, that was it.
Stamp. We finally have a solid answer, Chaz.
After yeah, man, that was it. Say that once more. That was kind of pretty.
All muskie decisions are based on caloric risk versus caloric reward.
That's nice, man. Caloric risk and caloric reward.
Wow.
That is a it is a beautiful thing, but it's scientific. It's you can't argue with some of the science in that, and we'll just leave it at that.
Well, and for all my Southerners that are as dumb as I am, what I always say, you know, you might not have room for a whole cheeseburger, but you could have a cheese nip.
You can always, and for us northern Wisconsin guys, you always got room for one cheese curd.
Just
one or two cheese.
My next question is from a guy named Stephen Paul. He claims he's a Muskie guide in Tennessee, and his question is, why do you guys want squeaky cheese curds?
I don't know. They just taste good.
Disgusting. Moving on to Corey. Corey's question says, I'm new to the electronic side of musky fishing. How can I better understand my unit as far as finding hard to soft transitions in a lake bed? And especially, how do I understand my side imaging? Wow. Cool question, man.
That is a cool question.
You want to fire away there, side imaging master?
Sure. Sure. I don't know. I call myself a master. Thank you. But first of all, read your manual.
Yep.
Yeah. It sounds boring.
I'm cutting you off, but God, yes. Download the PDF to your phone.
Please read the manual. They're written in very easy, reading comp level. No, I mean, I'm just throwing it out there as a teacher. It's not reading a science textbook. They're easy to read. Take the time to read it and understand how it works. Otherwise, you're going to get out there for the first day and not know what the hell's going on. And you will start a slippery slope of not understanding if you just don't start by reading. Reading's a beautiful thing.
Yes.
And that first and foremost. Secondly, do some experimentation and, troll hard bottoms, troll soft bottoms. Try to get an idea of what your unit is telling you and use lures that can tell you what you're feeling and seeing.
Which refers back to our trolling podcast, by the way. We talked about that, which, we don't have to.
Last November. Yeah. Or whatever. Yeah.
Drag a bait around until you feel those transitions. So sorry. Keep rolling.
No. Let's dual questions.
I can't answer any better. When you said with the manual, Kevin Pilarski, we keep giving shout outs, right? Kevin Pilarski from the Twin Cities, you and Brent Ogney. I know all about how many hours you drove around out there on the lake trying to figure the unit out and scanning, right? Don't learn your unit on the water, period. You know, don't play fun and games as far as learning that, because what seems to happen, and I'm not trying to get away from Corey's question completely, but on the same token, is spend driveway time with that thing, spend garage time, learn everything that you could possibly need to know.
When you go out there, you are confident when you push a button, you know what you're doing, and you're not second guessing yourself.
I've been on boats where it's by the time we're trying to mark a waypoint, we're 30 yards off of it.
Dude, I can't. You and I are both perfectionists, OCD nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't. I'm welcome to have somebody else. I'm getting on a tangent right now. I'm welcome to have somebody else run my boat, within reason, if you're a good buddy of mine.
Right.
Or but you better know what you're doing when you're looking at electronics or running a trolling motor, or else don't go up there. Because when you're on the water, it's business time.
Yeah.
When you're off the water, it's time to research, time to read, time to understand.
Absolutely.
Break things down. And again, I say that as a professional, but there obviously is a time to learn. And I would say that, again, you've got to put the time in with your unit, which no one does, before you get on the water.
Yep.
Watch YouTube. It sounds terrible, but
absolutely.
YouTube is you want to learn how to cook something? Go on YouTube.
Yep.
You want to learn how to tie a lure? Go on Stephen Paul's. You want to learn how to modify something? Watch Stephen Paul's new videos on modifying slot masters and, twin eights. Whatever it is.
Whatever.
You want to learn how to do something? Go on the internet and learn it.
I'll tell you.
Somebody has already done it before. Yep. 99% of the time, just put in – learn it online before you go on the water.
Dude, I flat out went through that here recently. I got new units in my boat. got a big old one there at the console. And so what I did is, like, I told, or actually I sort of planned, like, when I did my transition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I took the day off from guiding because, like, you know, I told the guy, I said, I need a day before, can I move you to this day, blah, 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 blah. So I had a day off, and I spent the day on YouTube, like, how do I, number one, how do I transfer my stuff? How do I, like, know every keystroke on this thing? Because, like, it's not the time to learn when you're on the lake, because what you're doing is you're taking away from your casting time or your trolling time. And so, you know, learn as much as you can. I learned everything I know about my big low rants unit from YouTube. That's it. You know, that's, it's flat. I mean, you can't say it any better. So spend the time there, put in whatever.
Or yeah. I would even say this, like, if you go out, don't go out to fish.
True. Yeah. Like, good point.
Just,
yeah.
Just go out to, like, screw around and explore. I can remember, gosh, 2 years ago when I got my new units on, I spent $5,000 on all uh-huh. that stuff. It's like, get out there without a fishing rod. Don't even open up the rod locker mm-hmm. and just, you know, with the manual on your phone, go out onto the water mm-hmm. and explore and, yeah. And change shit and, like, try stuff out and, right. like, you know, you gotta mess around with it until you get comfortable.
And like he asked too about like side imaging. I'll even tell you, like, on my boat, I had to play around with it where I have to kick my motor up. I have to have it trimmed up where, like, I've got a clear image completely. So you're gonna
Dude,
have to play
I'm
with
so
that.
Glad to hear that right now because I
you're a peasant like me, right?
No. You know why I gotta brag right now? Yeah. It's because I bought 2 transducers.
Oh, you suck.
You know, here's a shout out to Premier Power Sports in Saint Germain. Thank you, Brian, for convincing me to get 2 transducers, so I have no issue with the lower unit.
That's the end of the podcast, folks. Thank you much. Chaz will never be back on the show. Say goodbye to Chaz Martin. He's never coming back on the podcast.
You know,
later, folks. Cue the music.
You know what's kind of funny about this, by the way, is that when I was looking into this and I talked to Brian and
uh-huh. which are great people. They're such a killer advertiser for the app and friends of the whole crew here.
And I'll tell you what, Brian is a smart and all the guys
Absolutely.
There, but Brian is smart. He knows how to rig a boat like nobody else. And he's done all my, he rigged my E-Tech. He rigged all my Humminbird stuff. He got me in touch with some folks who got me in touch with some folks who got me in touch with some folks.
Uh-huh.
And I talked to, essentially the folks down in Madison who are, you know, involved in finding bodies and this and that. It's a tough subject, obviously, but they have double side scanning sonars, and he's like, dude, look, if you want a crystal, I'm getting way, this is a tangent,
yeah,
believe. But anyway, yeah, double side scanning transducers, man, you don't have to lift your engine up.
I hate you. All right. Well, thank you very much there, double transducer, Chaz Martin. Not even fair, folks. Not even fair. All right. Jimmy's got the next question. He says, hey, guys, I've been musky fishing for about 5 years now, and I fish mostly a narrow river system that has spots that get up to 100 feet deep in Ontario. Okay. So he's got really deep river here. I've caught muskies on weed lines and in the weeds and off of rocks, etc. But one day when I was night fishing, I was trolling around a weed line that I've had a lot of success around. On my way back, I was driving through open water around 80 feet deep and noticed catfish were porpoising around the boat. I've noticed this a couple of times. I'm not sure if I should target these muskies. Would they be feeding on these catfish? What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't want to speak too soon, Stephen, but you got to cover this one, dude.
I actually have encountered that with channel cats.
I know you have. That's why I said that. I know this is one of your expertise areas.
Remember that fish? I call it
peekaboo. I know what you're talking about.
Peekaboo. You know,
yep, I know what you're talking about.
So there's a fish that I caught a few years back. It's a big one. It's, you know,
yeah, 50. Like you said very kindly, it's a big one.
It's a big one. That fish came in a similar situation. So mm-hmm. catfish were on the surface. Yes, catfishermen, these things will come up on the surface at night. And catfish were coming up and they're feeding on what I would, I don't know exactly what they're feeding on, but I generically called it shiners, right? Small minnows. And what I did is I started casting the outer perimeter of it. This was in a moving water system in current, and I banged a monster. So yes, you can do that. Have I repeated?
I like that you, you went, boy, that's because I was like, dude, what you're talking about is really a serious concept and a serious it's a serious tactic, man. It's kind of scary to talk about on air right now.
Yeah, I mean,
but I mean, I think you hit it on the head. I mean, that's a great answer.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know if that does it justice, but it should.
If you find that scenario, that muskie was on the outer perimeter. Was he feeding on the shiners or was he feeding on the catfish? I don't know, nor do I care. It's a big fish, but
I think you and I are getting back, not to cut you off.
No,
this
go for
goes
it.
Back to your, you know, caloric. Like we're getting back scientific here, man.
Easy food, baby.
But well, think about this, right? I mean, in the sense that, like, you and I will always be in a town that is, you know, has a grocery store within driving distance. We have to be, or else we're going to die. You know, like muskies, even if they're not feeding on whatever they're near, they're going to, you know, biologically, they're going to be within range of a food source, even if they're not necessarily feeding on it. You know, instinctually, they have to be. Like they are programmed to be.
Those are going to be easy feeding. And I mean, to be honest with you, you know, as far as your question, I've repeated that like two other times. It's not something I've spent a lot of time on, you know, but it can pay off for you. So give it a shot.
But if it ever does again, I mean, look at the size of the fish. But you know what's kind of funny about that statement right there?
Yeah.
And this Joe talks about this, and here's our Hall of Fame legendary angler here.
Right.
I've been, as you have, but I've been with Joe in Canada numerous times. I'm going on a tangent here real quick, that you talk about it happened once. And when it did, or maybe, you know, for Joe, it's happened more than once, but you know, some of these situations have happened a small number of times, but it worked. And it means that it could happen again. So you have to try it again.
You got to try it again. Yeah.
You have to, because if it does, it's like, holy cow, the payoff could be monstrous.
Absolutely. You know? I mean, that's a thing. Every time I've seen it subsequently, I've given it.
Can you not go after that same scenario again?
No, I mean, like, it was sort of like his question. I sort of paraphrased it a little bit because it was a lengthy question. But I know it was weird when I read it because I know what he's getting at is like, am I crazy? You know, it's almost like in Jimmy's question. I'm sure Jimmy's listening now and he's thinking, okay, he gets what I'm saying. Is like one of these things that shouldn't be happening, and is there a chance? And I punched my ticket with a monster doing that. So,
exactly,
you know, there's always a chance,
sometimes you find that's the beauty of the wilderness. Sometimes the amount of time that all of us spend out in this outside world, sometimes you do find yourself in a unique situation every once in a while, and you might be looking around saying, is this easy? And you're like, sometimes timing just syncs up, and you might just find yourself in a really weird position where you're like, things are getting real, and you better make a cast,
because
you're never going to see that. You're never going to see that again, or it's going to be a long time before you see that lineup again.
Dude, once again, like the last podcast on Strange Days we were talking about, the biggest muskie you've ever seen was followed by the biggest muskie you've ever caught. And you haven't beat it yet.
Oh my God! I was thinking of Wisconsin for a second. Canada, yes, true.
Wisconsin.
Because dude, the line.
Yeah,
in my
and Wisconsin saw a 38 followed by a 36. I'm teasing. I'm teasing. We're gonna plug your new video. He's got a monster coming up here, folks.
You're absolutely right, though, man. The biggest muskie I'd ever seen, followed by the biggest muskie I'd ever caught on the same day. You're absolutely right.
Did that happen in Wisconsin as well, or just Canada?
Well, should I share the story in air?
Buddy, I'm six in. I don't care what you say.
Well, okay, I'm gonna share the story. The biggest, this is actually, I will never reveal this footage. This is footage that is stuck in the Muskie Mastery Vault.
What lake was it? What was the GPS? What's the GPS coordinates?
Nope,
did you use? What day was it?
So the footage is out. You know, it's titled as the biggest Wisconsin. It was the biggest muskie in Wisconsin I've ever hooked and lost. Unfortunately, the old GoPros don't ever do it justice.
Are you talking about the one? Hold on, I'm cut you off. Is that the one on the DR with the KVD hooks on?
Yep,
okay.
That's the KVD one that bent one out. I put too much pressure on it. Like, I mean, I've watched it 1,000 times, and I wish I had free spooled that fish better.
Come out on the boat with me. I'll teach you how to land them. I'm just busting you.
I mean, I gotta be honest. This is one for the books and listeners out there. We are on an official tangent now.
Absolutely.
So the day that I unfortunately lost that big fish, and it's kind of funny that I actually did film a real nice segment before I lost that fish that gets overshadowed by all these moments. It was a beautiful muskie that I don't think about as much. But after I lost the big one, I fished until complete darkness. I was a zombie and I couldn't stop casting.
Absolutely.
And I was on a reef. I was on a reef that topped out at 16 feet. Not the same reef I had lost that big muskie on. I'm out deep. I'm fishing rocks. I'm surrounded by 60 feet of water. I'm in the middle of nowhere and I'm the only guy out there on the water. And I got my GoPros. I got, you know, a bunch of different cameras running. And I sling the old straight model DR, and literally I look over my left shoulder as the lure, I mean, like, the lure is mid-flight.
Mm-hmm.
I look over my Steven, I haven't even told you the story.
Yeah.
I've only told this story to Joe, and because I knew Joe and I had talked about this for years, and I knew it was going to happen someday. Mm-hmm. Because it was going to happen,
inevitable. Yeah.
And I'm, you know what, this might get me in some hot water. I don't know, but I'm going to tell the story anyway.
We're having fun, baby.
I'm too deep. And so anyway, I look over my shoulder and there's a pair of loons that are flying, and literally my depth radar is just like mid, like just the highest speed it can be, like full, it's out. And one of the loons it clips my line, not the lure, but it clips the line.
Uh-huh.
And the loon kind of goes tumbling. And I start ripping my rod up to just try to get my lure out of the way. I didn't know what was hooked or what was going on. And all of a sudden, I'm toe-to-toe with a loon. And,
oh, God.
Dude, I'm telling you, this was one of the weirdest things. And I wish it would never happen. But, like, literally, I mean, I'm serious about that. I wish it never happened. I'm toe-to-toe with a loon. The other one went on and kept flying. And so here I am. I'm in the middle of nowhere by myself. And I'm like, okay, I remember I've talked to Joe about this. Joe had this happen to him in his younger days.
I'm going to tell you flat out, so nobody can rag Chaz more than that. When I was about 14 years old, I hooked a loon that was following a bait. And if you fish Canada long enough, you've seen them follow baits. So,
oh God, they're some of them can be super aggressive.
Yeah.
And but this was just a pure accident. And they were just flying across. I ripped the deer out on a cast, clipped it, it somehow gets hooked. And so now I'm fighting this loon in, and it's like it's all on video, and it's like it's terrible, obviously, and it sounds bad. And I mean, and I'm free spooling the loon. You're talking about free spooling?
Yeah.
And this thing's diving. And I'm like, and the only reason I'm fighting it is because my thought is I'm gonna get this thing close, I'm gonna net it, and I'm gonna get the hooks out of this thing.
Absolutely.
Because Joe told me back in the day, he netted one by himself. He put a rain jacket over it. He took the hooks out and let it go.
Right.
And that's always been, you know, Joe Bucher. I've looked up to him in so many ways. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do what Joe did. And so I'm fighting this loon in, Stephen. I'm fighting it in. And it sounds terrible, but I was. They're big birds, man.
Yeah.
And this thing, it gets close to the boat. And I'm telling you, this is when I lost my shit. All of a sudden, its mate comes back.
Oh, my
oh, dude, I've got this thing about 10 yards, like it seems closer than I ever want to be to a loon, and
yeah.
I'll never forget this. I'm looking at it, and its mate comes right next to it, and they're looking at me like their red eyes are like as big as like pennies.
Yeah.
And I could hear them audibly, like you could hear them chomping their beaks. And I'm like, okay, like I'm like, sanity check, Chase, you net that thing that's literally bigger than the turkeys you've eaten on Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh.
And what is its buddy gonna do to you?
Yeah.
And so this is what I did. I cut the line and I called the DNR the next day. I reported it. I said, hey, man, this is the lake I was on. This is what happened. I am so sorry about this, but please look.
Okay, I'm gonna alleviate the pressure with you.
I felt scared, man, because when the other one came in, and they looked really like they were mad.
They're mad. If we're having Mia Copas here on the podcast, this is a lot of my guy clients have heard this story. Like, you always end up on the weirdest thing. Yeah. I foul hooked a beaver with a DR.
No way, dude.
I'm going.
Oh, I mean, that would be the laugh.
Like, I'm going. No, dude. Like, I don't want you to feel bad. Cause people, if you're the people that are listening here, me and Chaz love doing this podcast, and we always like. It's so familiar. It's like me and you talking on the phone. So we just like there's stuff we would never talk about, and it just spews out, and we love it.
Yeah, this
so,
one I'm surprised I threw this story up, but I'm glad you threw in your story with the beaver.
I'm trolling.
Can I just yeah. say this once more? Like when you spend like
enough time,
that much time on the yeah. water, like just things happen.
So, dude, I'm trolling. So, got four wide, right?
Mm-hmm.
Couple. I think I had like one of my big jakes out. I got a pretty good spread. And I'm pretty notorious for having two DRs out. And it was the inside, like close to the shallows DR. And if I remember correctly, it was a straight sucker, right? And that's just been a banging lure for me forever. And so I'm never shocked if that rod goes off. And I'm sitting there, and the client, we haven't seen crap all day long. You know,
we're talking
about the grind. Like the dude that asked the question about the grind earlier, like it's a grind. And this guy's like, does this guy even know where a muskie's at? And so we're going, and it's like, bang. Like I can't. I'm gonna pass out before I can like even make the sound of how much
you're
line
like,
sucking out.
You're world record.
You're right. I'm like Muskiezilla. And I promise you, I put this put the boat in neutral. I'm grabbing like the other three rods, getting the planer boards up to the front, and get the other one out of the way. The dude's like, I can't get this out of the holder. And I'm like, what? He's like, I can't get it out of the holder. And it is literally down to my backing on the trolling rod, which on my trolling rods, I don't.
It's because you only got half a spool.
I was about to say, I have more line on my trolling reels, I promise. But I'm seeing backing coming off this thing. I'm like, oh, man. And the whole time I'm like, this is it, boys. This is the big one. And he gets control of it. And so I actually start backing the boat towards the fish, right? You know, so there's like water coming over the back of the boat. I'm reversing the boat so he can pick up slack. And we fight this thing, and it is making the most insane runs you've ever seen. Like, it is just like,
imagine.
The rod is just
50 pound beavers.
Yeah, the rod is just undulating. And I'm sitting here like, I don't know if I need to get the net or call field or stream. You know, it's just like, do I need to just go ahead and get Larry Ramsell on the phone and say, get here now before I even net the thing?
Right?
You know, fly Booker down, Ramsell, they're going to see it. Get Tom Gelb here because game on. And anywho, this rod is just going, the drag screaming, and after honest to goodness, and you know how it is, like on even a 40 pound muskie, it's not a 3-4 minute affair most times. You know, it's over pretty quick. This is going on for way too long, so I start getting real suspect about when it hits the 2 minute mark, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And I've not seen any collar off the fish. I've not seen a fish yet. All I know is this thing's just like, it'll rip 50 yards of or 50 yards of line, then we can pick it back up. Finally, we come up, and there is a DR stuck in the tail of a beaver that's the size of a Labrador. And I did the same thing. I looked at this fish, and I was like, I looked at this beaver, and I went, I'm going to net it and try to save it. And we got it 10 feet off the boat, and I went, no, there's no way. I'm going to lose a finger. I'm going to, you know, my net's going to be destroyed. I'm going to get rabies, you know.
Oh, my God. I couldn't imagine something like, because I think a lot of, like, if you haven't been in that scenario, I mean, albeit jokes aside, whether it's a beaver or a loon, like, I think it's easy for folks to say, yeah, oh, I would have netted that thing, or I would.
Oh yeah, yeah, right.
You know, a lot of, and I'm not saying any listeners are saying that, but I'm saying a lot of folks that you and I meet at sports shows. Oh, I would have netted that. I would have done this.
That's the same old crap. Yes, it's
everybody says that,
dude.
And
it's like
when you're in the heat of the moment and you're face to face with an animal that can hurt you, and you're there by mistake. Like you didn't, and like 9, 10 times out of 10, all of us want to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, you're overmatched, and like,
dude,
you know,
that's armchair quarterback, dude.
Yeah. Well, we said this on the last podcast. You know, respect Mother Nature, man. Sometimes these critters are, you know, they're mean dudes. You know.
All right. The next question up. We are having a blast here, folks. We're both on lockdown, so we're gonna get through. We got four more here. The next one up is from Seamus. This question comes from YouTube, and it's directed towards Chaz.
Oh, boy.
Seamus says, how did you become an elite angler, Chaz? I feel like a noob compared to your skill set. Sort of a poignant question from a guy named Seamus. What do you think, Chaz? How did you become an elite angler?
I certainly, Seamus, is very, very kind of you. I certainly would not call myself by any means an elite angler. I would call myself a learning angler and somebody that's hungry all the time to gain information from any source it is, whether it's from guys like Steven or Joe Bucher or all these guys that I fish with, Tyler Andrews, or if it's clients or if it's just time in the water myself. Like there's, you know, I think that I have become, you know, as I look at myself, professional or not, I've become better at catching muskies because I put time in over the years, and I've focused on, you know, I focus on areas of opportunity, like where can I improve on?
Yeah.
And when that's it. Like, and it's, I really just think it's time on the water. And I think it is a Gelb statement. It's spending intelligent time on the water. It's not just going out there and fishing willy nilly. It's going out there and thinking when you're out there and self, we talked about this on this podcast so far, self-reflection is, you know, like spending time reflecting on what went down, what happened, trying to analyze, bouncing ideas off your partner, you know, bouncing ideas off your buddy, calling up old Stephen Paul, say, hey, look, man, this is what happened today. This is what we encountered. What would you have done? Or, you know, there's so many things that go into it, you know.
That question is directed to you, but once again, we're into tangent land.
Yeah,
you're saying self-reflect. I'm going to say this.
I'm going to say one last thing. This
okay,
this
is my, lay it on me. I got a follow up.
But I already said it. Is it just the same thing? Time on the water. There's no substitute for time on the water. I'm done. I'm out.
Okay, right. Here's the thing. The thing I would add to that is being self-aware. Being willing to go, I suck at glide baits. I suck at big rubber. My figure eight is weak. Like one thing I will do is this is, and it's just common for me to do is I will film myself with my iPhone for a little bit doing retrieves and then pick it apart. Okay. And I said the thing about armchair quarterback. I know this sounds ridiculous, but I will film myself doing certain retrieves and going, okay, how could I improve that? And that's called being self-aware because you go, okay, how long are my pauses really? Am I pausing it for a half a second because I'm impatient and I haven't caught a fish in 2 days and I'm getting antsy? Or am I disciplined in my retrieves? Am I disciplined in everything that I'm doing? And that is like, if you want to like, sort of kick it up a notch, be willing to like self-critique and be self-aware of go, I suck at this.
This is getting me, now you're really getting me on I completely agree with you, and you're getting me in this mindset right now. So for those of you out there who may not know this, I have been a competitive golfer for a long time, not as much now as I used to be, but when I want to share this mantra, if you will.
Absolutely.
And my swing coach, so I played all throughout high school and shortly in college. A lot of tournament golf and as mean of a competitor as you could imagine. I seem like a pretty nice guy, but and I am. I'm the nicest.
He's a dog, folks.
The nice. Well, you know what? The weird thing. The nicest mean guy you'd ever meet on the golf course.
Absolutely.
Like, when it comes to like competition, like I want to win. I want to beat you, and I will do what I got to do within legal realms to do it. And I'll get in your head. Anything I got to, like the golf course is, I mean, like it's tennis is the same way. Like
absolutely.
I love competing. And anyway, my old swing coach told me this, and this statement, I can't do the story justice, but I'll try my best because I think it's kind of a cool story. And I think it does relate to Muskies in this question. There's a kid walking with his grand. This is my swing coach in high school told me this story, because I always told my swing coach, I said, Gary, I want to be the best golfer I can be. And he said, well, let me tell you a story, Chaz. And he goes, well, there's a grandpa walking with his grandson, and the grandson's telling his grandpa, I want to be the best golfer. I want to be this. I want to be that. And the grandpa takes the kid by the neck and shoves his head underwater.
Mm-hmm.
And he holds him there, man. And you know, bubbles are coming up, and the kid is he's on his last breath, something like that. And he brings the kid out and throws him on the shore. And he said, you know, if you want to be all what you just asked, you got to want it like you wanted that last breath.
Mm-hmm.
And that has stuck with me. I think it transpires everything we do.
Absolutely.
It's like if you want to be the best, you've got to read everything you get your hands on. You've got to watch everything you can get your hands on. You've got to do. I mean,
that goes back to the question the dude asked earlier about how you get through a rough bite. How do you get past that three day grind? You got to want it.
You've got to want it. And like, you've got to want it bad.
You got to want. I mean, you're sitting here and me and Chaz and Joe and like the whole crew of us, the guru, everybody that participates in Muskie 360, it's not an hour long podcast that we're talking about muskies. It's like 24/7, 365, man. It's a lifestyle.
It is a lifestyle, but I gotta share. No, I'm getting like real weird now on these stories. I got another one, Stephen.
I'm cracking number seven. I'm getting real weird, baby.
This is a Joeism, man.
Yeah.
This is a Joe story. I've been very fortunate over the years to have spent a lot of time
absolutely
not just fishing with Joe, but traveling in the truck with him, and that's actually some of my fondest memories. Listening to blues music and just kicking his brain on a 10-hour drive to Lake of the Woods. And, you know, over the years, one of the things that it makes me think, like, oh, Chaz, you think you're a hard ass? Well, Joe just told me this.
Right.
And Joe will share stories of, Joe is kind of one of those guys that walk the walk, talk the talk guys.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he said this story more than once, which is kind of always interesting. It makes you think like it's not a fake story. I mean, it is obviously a real story that when he was younger, I mean, he would sleep in his boat at night, get up. He would bring his breakfast and milk in his boat in Canada on his Canadian trip. Beth would be running Booker tackle back in Eagle River or in Boulder Junction. And then he would get up, eat breakfast and go. And I'm like sitting there saying, holy shit, man.
Yeah,
it's like, you think you're hard going to bed and getting up and
having a couple beers there at the cabin
and you're
catered breakfast.
Explaining to me how he was so like enamored with muskies that had jumped or he'd seen or he had caught, and he was so nuts. He wouldn't ever go in. He said he would eat and sleep in his boat and just keep going. I'm like, man, that's another level. I personally haven't gotten there, but that's like, you talk about like, how do you bring yourself to the next level? Like, just, I mean, like, shit, man. Like,
dude, that's, you know, that's what he did on those French River fish.
That's exactly.
Dude,
that's what I'm talking.
Yeah.
He
and I talked about that. That's actually the truck drive as well, where he, you know, we were just talking about crazy stuff. And he said, I bathed myself off in the river while I had the anchor down and then started casting. Like, if I have not come home and gotten 8 hours of sleep in my own bed, I'm miserable. You know, I'm such a bitch.
Well, I mean, but I gotta admit, like, I mean, I am humbled and Seamus, like, to I mean, honestly, and that I'm humbled to be throwing a question there like that. But in all honesty, like, you know, boy, there's never an end to your. I guess the other thing I would say is there's never an end to the learning, right, Stephen? Like,
it never ends.
If you think for a minute that you like know more than somebody else in muskie fishing, or
forget about it.
Yeah, man, for you are in the wrong.
Goodness,
deal,
well, that was a fun tangent. Me and Tangent Martin here were the worst. We're the worst. But man, you nailed it.
We got three questions left.
We'll get through them, folks. All right, Justin B. I have a problem finding fish, particularly in rivers. Watch my new vlog. After spawn, typically water temps are around 65 to 70 degrees. Do the fish move out to the channels 8 feet deep or so, or will they hang out in the wild rice 4 feet deep? Any help would be greatly appreciated. Love the podcast. Thank you. We appreciate all your support. Obviously, he's talking wild rice. He's up in your neck of the woods, so it's going to be a little bit more in your ballpark. But, man, he's talking 65, 70-degree water temp.
I was just going to ask you a question.
Yeah, later on.
Your new vlog is 65 degrees sounds to me like you're just post-spawn, or you're kind of in that recuperation stage. Uh-huh. Where are muskies spending time? Where are your small males going to be most active after the spawn?
Man, they're going to be – these little males, at least when I'm thinking like that low 30s to upper 30s male –
yeah, right. He's, like you and I are talking about putting our lures on muskies, not caring what the size are.
He's gonna be up tight in that warmer stuff, in my opinion. Yes, you know, he's gonna be holding nose up in the shallow stuff. You know, and Justin saying he's having a problem finding these fish. If you're positive that they're post spawn, downsize, because those are there, and those males, man, they are just. They're wicked right after post spawn.
Oh, they're brutal.
You catch a ton of those males that are torn up, ate up. They just got their love bites all over them. They're ready to eat something. So first thing, like I said, pops in my head is downsizing. The one thing, like you said, that 65 to 70 degree surface temp. I mean, am I crazy or is that a little hot for? I mean, I would think we're a little bit more post spawn, or is that going to be?
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I mean, in the 60s, like mid 60s and whatnot, it just made me think when you're talking about wild rice and stuff. The one thing I wanted to throw in there, is that, you know, if it's brown, as far as weeds are concerned, that does not mean it's out of the question.
Yeah.
In that,
Chaz Martin said, if it's brown, he's down, folks. So.
If it's brown, we're definitely gonna fish it early in the season, because don't forget those darker colors are absorbing heat. It's sometimes, and you're gonna find everything around those dead. You know, it looks dead, and you might be thinking to yourself, well, you know, there's nothing here, but all those minnows, all those crappies, and those panfish are gonna be up in that dead reeds and those dead. They're all in there.
Justin, your question sounds more like a size class lure presentation or a speed thing. You're nailing it, because, man, if we're talking, like you threw us through that, those post spawn males, those things are just usually stupid. They're ready to go. So I would downsize and I would slow down.
And are we on a river, or where are we?
Well, he said it's in a river. Yeah, 65 to 70 degrees on a river. So he said the deeper channels, they're 8 feet or so deep. I mean, you can cover all that a lot of times, you know, unless it's like a wide river that's in that. But
yeah, boy, I would be getting out of the moving. And then, now correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd be getting out of the moving current.
Absolutely.
Be getting into that slack water
where
I've just got emergent cover, and I've got dead wood. I'm looking for dead timber. I'm looking for just junk.
Current breaks, eddies, pools, and holes, man. If he's asking about that hanging out in that wild rice, I would be in that. I would just, like, my guts just tell me that you're throwing too big and you're throwing too fast.
Yep. And you know, that goes back to what we said so many times in this podcast. Cold water, slow down.
Yeah, absolutely. Wally's up next. Is it better to fish a full moon or a new moon?
Ooh, ooh. Interesting one.
Me, where I'm at down south, I think new moons are better, by the way.
I was going to agree with you on that very much. I think it's it depends on the cloud cover, but yeah, I'm going to have to actually pretty much agree.
Dude, I hate full moons.
New moon, yeah, new moons are generally more powerful, you know, later in the month than a new moon or a full moon. Excuse
Everybody
me.
Gets hung up on like full moon stuff, and I'm sitting here going, if you want to fish the full moon, you want to fish it effectively, you better be out there after dark.
Well, that or like it's like I'm always a believer in like it's the days before or after.
Yeah.
The day of the full moon is always like a shit show. Like,
yeah, I agree.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, how many times have you and I guided where it's like clients are booking on a full moon? I'm like, and it's always like, oh my God, you should have been here yesterday.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, what do you mean? That wasn't that? Well, yeah. It's like the days leading up to the full moon are freaking awesome.
But yeah.
But in the new moon is a weird one. Like the day of the new moon, I agree with you. Like that shit's just,
it's fire. That's,
yeah, it's good. It's good.
Once again, we were talking about peekaboo, that big one that was in that new moon period.
Oh man.
Where it's just like, you know, my deal with a full moon, I'm 100% like a billion percent with you on leading up and like slightly thereafter. The day of the full moon, if we don't have a bunch of cloud cover, even on days that you have a bunch of cloud cover, it seems like they're waiting to do their business at like 4 a.m. or something kooky.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's just like they know that something's gonna pop off and they just wait you out where it feels like it's like slow. You know, new moon, and if they know, I think these muskies feel that they're not gonna have any light to work with after sundown. A lot of times, like, there's a really dominant, you know, twilight bite, and then you'll get, you know, a couple hours after sundown on a new moon, you'll get another window. But, you know, I'm 100% with you where people are like, oh, full moon, full moon, full moon. I don't necessarily want to be out there the day of the full moon that often.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree that, like, I guess I would say this, that, like, big fish predominantly will like there. I think there's a bigger percentage of larger fish in a system that move on either of those 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I agree that a new moon seems to produce, I would say just as far as action for sure, like new moon will produce more muskies generally for some reason. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, in Wally, I mean that it could be the difference between, if we're talking spring, summer, winter, or fall, you know, a litany of different things that could influence that. But yeah, you're asking what we think. We're going new moon. And the last one we got,
all right, we've gotten
through this week's questions.
Hey man, let me say this. If you're on a long ride, man, this podcast is for you.
Cause it is like 7 hours long here, folks. My wife has left me. I'm homeless now. I'm starving to death. We've been on this podcast for 9 years. The last one episode.
I ate my frozen pizza before this. All right, last
absolutely. It's John. He said, I'm referring to Spence Petros's article. He says, how do you puff or flare out lures? Excuse me. How do you puff or flare out a lure's skirt when casting? Go Wait, for it, buddy.
When casting?
How do you make a bucktail skirt puff?
During the cast?
Yes. What he's talking about is flaring. He's talking about speed up, slow down, which he doesn't know
retrieval.
That, but that's the answer.
Cast.
Yeah. If you want to make a skirt puff out, speed up, slow down. It goes.
Burst it.
Yeah, burst it.
Absolutely. It's easy. It's as easy. It sounds really complicated, but it's as easy as speed up quick, slow down, speed up quick, slow down. That's it.
That's it.
I mean, that's it. And if you got marabou or you got something more feathery like a tinsel or a marabou, it's going to be more pronounced. If you've got a bucktail, it's going to be a little harder to see. It will happen. But you know, the more, if you want to pronounce that flaring and puffing, use a finer type of skirt. You know, that's what I would say if you want to see more of that. Like a boot tail or something like that, you're going to see a lot more puff and flare out of it. Or a tinsel, you're going to see, I'd say, a medium. And then your buck hair, you're going to see a little less.
And, I mean, perfect example of that is Joe's fishing with a guy named Luke Sweet from Evinrude.
Oh, yeah, Luke Sweet.
And he tells, you know, give it a little speed up there in the middle of the cast. And that's all you're doing. Like, if you... If you're going like a steady pace and you give it like three or four turns, you know, you use quick little jump in there, that'll cause that skirt to undulate and puff out when it's, you know, it sort of changes speeds like that. And that can trigger a lot of strikes. So, Chaz, we have been on the podcast for 473 years now because we're on lockdown and there's nothing else to do.
I got to say, Stephen, if I might, and we'll see what the listeners think, but I think I had an absolute blast as always. And I think we in some regard stayed on track, and even almost, though it took us a long time, we really did have a couple tangents as always, I feel confident though that we did answer our questions pretty thoroughly tonight,
to the best of our ability. So you know, and that's the thing, me and Chaz love doing these Q&A podcasts. Folks, keep sending your questions. We're going to give you the best answer we can come up with here on the podcast. Again, Chaz, thank you so much. Thank you, listeners. We'll be hearing from you soon.